Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is.
Catherine Benamou, I'm Professor of Film Media Studies at the University of California, Irvine.
And Catherine, it's wonderful to see you. I think it might be 20 years since we were last chatting together. Yeah?
I think so.
Could be. And lovely, lovely to reconnect. I wanted to start out by asking you about what is currently preoccupying, dynamizing, worrying, interesting you. And I've had a hint there might be more than one thing.
Yes, that is the case. The first project that I'm working on right now has to do with the pursuit of social justice in relation to Spanish language television. And I decided to look more closely in the Los Angeles metropolitan area at how Spanish language television stations providing local news to their audiences in the Los Angeles DMA are actually making use of community organizations, and also how these community organizations are somewhat dependent on these television outlets for getting word out to their constituencies. And will also remediate what Spanish language networks are doing through their own websites and social media. And so I've interviewed about 12 organizations so far. And it's been really interesting to see just how many organizations there are out there helping people in need in the Latinx community. And they vary really widely, all the way from organizations that help people with citizenship applications, helping people get jobs, to organizations helping translate from native languages to Spanish. And also that operate their own low power radio stations. There are two organizations I interviewed that do that. So they have a wide range of functions. I'm also interested in actually how they become involved in news gathering activity. So it's been a little bit more difficult to get a hold of people for interviews from the media end. Because I wanted to interview media professionals and see how they felt about this and what were their own views about the role of the journalists as compared to what the community organizations think that role should be. And so the community organizations are practically unanimously saying that they think the role should be that the journalist makes use of their own position to help empower the communities they serve and even maybe advocate for those communities, which departs a little bit from our idea of media objectivity, I would say. The other project involves community-based media that is coming out of Africa in two locations in particular. One is Port Harcourt, North Nigeria, which is the oil capital of Nigeria. And I came into contact with the director of a project called the Chikoko Collective, which actually has a low power radio station and also has been making podcasts about the situation in Port Harcourt. And the other project, which is linked through a larger project that is not of my authorship, but is linked to them, is in Goma in Eastern Congo. And that is a film school called Yole Africa. And they actually teach refugees how to make films. And they've been embroiled now in a terrible tragedy because basically the refugee population grew by 1 million about a month ago because of attacks by the M23 militia on the area near the refugee camps. So people are fleeing their homes in eastern Goma. And Yole Africa, as a film school that also operates a farm, they've had to be feeding a lot of refugees lately because the UN is not offering enough assistance.
Grief.
So what I'm trying to do is to initiate kind of a cross-cultural exchange between these organizations and the community organization in Santa Ana, California, which is near Irvine, that's called the Centro Cultural de México. And they also have a micro farm, and they also have a low power radio station, and they have music classes. And so I'm trying to set up a kind of synergistic encounter between these groups and see what comes out of it. And I think one of the media makers, Petna Dalico, who's from Goma, I think he's interested in making a film about this. We'll see where it goes.
Wow. Getting back to the first preoccupation, Prof. C, one of the things that a lot of listeners may not know, a plurality of listeners is in the United States, but a majority is not, is that, and even US listeners probably won't know this, vast numbers of workers entering the United States, the Western United States from Latin America, are not Spanish speakers. They're often agricultural workers who are indigenous and only deal in indigenous languages. And so for them to work on farms, one of the things that they often need to learn is a second language, which is Spanish.
Yes.
Right? And this is something well known by you, but may not be so known by our audience. And I really appreciated your drawing attention to that fact by talking about translation and education services being provided by the community. My query about what you said in that first preoccupation project is about interviewing journalists. You said that it had proven quite difficult to get hold of them, pin them down. My experience is that they're hard to pin down and they're terrible interviewees. Because however narcissistic they may or not be, may be or not be, it's been ingrained in them that they are not the story.
Yes.
Yeah?
Right. Yes.
But related to that, I was interested when you mentioned objectivity, if you could talk a bit more on that score, because one of the issues that a lot of NGOs, third sector organizations, are facing when trying to funnel material to the bourgeois media, you know, here's footage we shot, here's a story we wrote, is that very established, relatively liberal news organizations don't want that. They want to be able to say, our person took the photo, our person took the video, or we got this from a concerned citizen. We don't want to be recycling your propaganda of your organization. So I wondered about that conceit or that issue in the context of what you've been uncovering.
Yes. Well, they actually depend on these organizations, sometimes for expert opinions. So, you know, they'll be reporting on a topic. And there's a great program, actually, that Univision has in Los Angeles called Al Punto California. And for Al Punto California, the whole program is basically their anchors interviewing experts from organizations. The organizations are not always happy about what has been cut out of their interviews, but at least they're getting a word in there. And the other thing is that the organizations will always let these media know when they have an action, you know, when they have a march or when they have a demonstration. And that's, of course, always very sexy for, you know, television. So that isn't as problematic. But what they would like to see more of these organizations is coverage of their day-to-day activities so that there's an awareness of where the needs are in the LA metro area in terms of different services. And so that's not really happening very much enough. They would like a journalist who feel a commitment to showing the struggle of local Latinx members of the audience, and not to sort of sort of shy away from that because of the need of impartiality.
And we're talking here about affiliates of Univision and Telemundo.
Telemundo and TV Estrella, which
TV
is
Estrella.
based in Burbank, yeah.
Right. So they've got, on the one hand, their licensing notions, but also their doctrines of professional journalism that are very powerfully laid out in
Yes.
US journalism schools or J schools, however absurd they may be, and however effectively they've militated against the interests of the working class and people of color for centuries.
So
Nevertheless, yeah.
it creates a kind of tiering, right, of social relations between the journalist and people they're interviewing. And I think in order for the social contract to be maintained with these media, which is very important to their own livelihoods because they need to appeal to these audiences who are very vulnerable and mostly disenfranchised, they need to take into account how this social contract is important. And part of that involves gaining the trust of the audience and of the community organizations representing that audience.
And
So.
speaking of that, Prof, you've looked into these audiences in some detail. So for listeners, especially outside California, but especially the US, could you say something about the role of television for Spanish-speaking audiences in contrast to Anglo audiences?
Yes, television is very important, especially to first generation population in the US. Linear Spanish language television is still the medium of choice. It's still ahead of print media and radio. A lot of the radio in the LA area, for example, is music and not news. So if we're talking about getting information and staying informed, we're talking about television. So there are reasons. This is something I did in my interviews for my book, Transnational Television and Latinx Diasporic Audiences. I actually interviewed people and asked them how they would rank the reasons for watching Spanish language television. And basically, one of the first reasons was to stay informed about immigration policy. Staying informed about what's happening in their home countries because this is transnational television. They're not reporting as much on South America and Central America. Now, the foreign reporting for these large outlets is mainly to Mexico. But we still get news from different Latin American countries, and that is an important reason for people to watch. In terms of what kind of services are available to them locally, that is an important reason for watching. And also to feel that they are participating sociopolitically in US society. That's a very important reason as well.
And most of the folks that you're dealing with here are either of Mexican origin or Central American, presumably.
That depends on the city where I did the research. In LA, it's primarily Mexican and Central American with some South American. In Detroit, it was quite a range of nationalities, but heavily Mexican. In Miami, it was Cuban American, Puerto Rican, and Central American. There were a lot of Central Americans also in Miami and some Spaniards.
And these are the three cities that
In the
you.
United States, and the fourth city was Madrid.
And
So,
here I am in Madrid.
yes.
Tell me all about it.
Well, what I did in Madrid was I was interested in knowing whether the Latin American migrant population in Madrid, how they felt in relation to Spanish media. And whether they still felt themselves to be migrants, and including the younger people. So what I did was I was working with the CEPIs, which are the Centros de Participación e Integración de Migrantes. which is something that Madrid has that other cities in Spain do not, which is basically these government-funded centers where they offer job advice, classes to help give them skills that they need for jobs, give them access to computers, language classes, and so on for people who have primarily indigenous language. There were a lot of indigenous people actually that I interviewed in Madrid. Yes, and so they definitely felt that they were somehow, if we can say, othered, in their experience in Spain. And they were very critical of TVE and other Spanish networks for not giving them access to information about Latin America. So they were getting the information from online digital newspapers and from radio. There's public radio in Madrid that is geared toward the diaspora. So yeah, it was really interesting. And they also had a very keen idea of how immigrants were sort of hierarchized in the Spanish national imaginary, and how Latin Americans were given preference, of course, over Maghrebi migrants.
One of the
And
things I've noted with the students that I'm involved with here who are working class and lower middle class is that, like the faculty who are middle class, they have no interest whatsoever in Latin America. Nothing. Unless they're from there, in which case they're interested both in Spain and in the region that
yes.
they're from. But I've been quite shocked by the lack of involvement or concern academically of professors
Yes.
as well as students. It's really striking, quite amazing to me. It's a very endogamous scholarly world here, I think.
Wow.
And also, the students are just not that interested in Latin Americans. And so many Latin Americans whom I meet are a bit like Latin Americans in Britain. They're speaking like this. They're whispering in public,
Wow.
very quiet. They are not angry.
Yes.
It's quite striking and quite demoralizing. And I suppose it's to do with a residual imperialism that is still quite thriving here and actually becomes a big political issue. But as you say, next to people from North Africa, Latin Americans are welcome.
Yes.
This is a fascinating study. What an amazing book. How long did it take you to do this? Came out 2 years ago, right? The Transnational
Yes, came
Television.
out 2 years ago. Yes.
It must have taken you decades to research.
It took me over a decade. Yes. So I started the year that Univision launched a station in Detroit and was very interested in following how that developed. Unfortunately, they discontinued the station in 2008 during the recession, because they couldn't get enough advertising dollars from Detroit. It would continue even though the need was there. The population was definitely there, and they could have expanded if they had sort of stayed in there, but they didn't. And it's also the year that TV Globo launched satellite transmission to the US after they did to Japan. So I was interested in looking at how what TV Globo was doing in the United States as well. And of course, we have the Immigration Rights March of 2006. So that was a good reason for starting at that time. And then I tracked it for a little over a decade more. So
One of the big limitations of a lot of scholarship is that it doesn't cross over between the Spanish language and Portuguese language worlds. And I think this is one of the many strengths of what you do, that the Lusophone world is not left on its own, but it is instead made as central as the Spanish language one. And Of course, in the case of Globo, we're talking about one of the great media successes of the last 80 years, right? Globally. And some of that is mixed up in all kinds of political economic issues, but some of it is also to do with particular genres. And one of the genres you examine is the telenovela
Yes.
in both languages. Could you share with us, Prof, a little bit about what you learned about the telenovelas in Portuguese and in Spanish and their circulation amongst diasporic communities?
Well, the telenovelas that I was interested in looking at were the ones that were inscribing the process of migration somehow, and addressing those diasporic audiences. Globo had a telenovela called America, which was about a young woman who goes from Minas Gerais to Florida via Mexico. And that was a very popular telenovela. Then, of course, we see that the Globo telenovelas are retransmitted in Spanish via Telemundo. So Globo, when we think about Globo, we have to think not only of the Brazilian diasporic population, but also a lot of Latinx viewers who are actually interested in Globo telenovelas, especially the Avenida Brasil was very popular both among Brazilians here and among Latinx viewers. I was interested in telenovelas that actually not only themselves are global, but actually speak to processes of globalization and displacement, population displacement. And some of the Televisa telenovelas were also addressing this experience. But what I found was that basically, there isn't so much of a gender differentiation, I think, as Esther Hamburger found in Brazil with her study of telenovelas in Brazil, that it's not as gendered as one would think, that people tend to watch these in order to get in touch with the world that they knew, before they migrated. And that can be as important for male viewers as it is for female viewers. And I think now what's interesting is that this seems to be tapering off. I'm not noticing as much references to migration in telenovelas. Instead, they're just sort of creating these telenovelas and expecting them to sell, because that is what they're showing on television. So there seems to be a little bit more indifference toward the audience now. And Globo is definitely marketing to Brazilians in the United States, but it's now sort of funneling everything through Globo Play, which is a streaming platform. And so it's not tailoring things as much now to diasporic viewers as it did before. It's making its product available to those diasporic viewers. I think we may be seeing a change, a shift from actual transnational cultural incorporation to more global, just sort of broadcasting the product out there and seeing it get picked up by different audiences.
And if we could move on to the African community media work now.
Yes.
And then inevitably, I'm going to drag you to It's All True.
Oh my goodness.
Us more about what's going on in Port Harcourt and so on, and the reasons for your hoping to connect these two quite disparate worlds in Southern California and Africa.
Port Harcourt as the oil capital. As my friend Michael Wimedimo, who is the director of CMAP, Project, which oversees the Chicoco Collective, says that they basically are interested in what is beneath the surface of the land, right? They're interested in the oil, and they're not interested in the surface except to develop more either industrial areas or luxury areas along the coast of Port Harcourt. So there's massive evictions. Sometimes tens of thousands of people can get evicted in one weekend. So basically, the way the project started was that Michael had a video camera, and he happened to be on site when one of these evictions was happening, and he documented the eviction as it was taking place. So one of the themes that is unifying these three projects is the theme of gentrification and how you can respond to gentrification and develop a sort of form of cultural resilience. Because, of course, it's not just a practical problem of where people are going to live or how they're going to live, but also their social networks and their cultural expression. So the Chicoco Project is dedicated to providing multiple means of cultural expression, all the way from live music performance to podcasts where people will narrate their experience with what's happening in their neighborhoods. And I have to say that it's definitely multi-ethnic in character, that it's Igbo, as well as Yoruba, as well as other groups that are participating in this. So this idea of a multi-ethnic population that is looking for its very cultural survival, I think, has a lot of counterparts in Santa Ana, which is the largest Spanish-speaking city in California. In terms of the proportion of Spanish speakers, it's the most Spanish-speaking city, and also has an indigenous population as well. In terms of Doma, I think there is a concern for environmental justice and preserving the natural habitat and developing sort of organic farming methods. And this, of course, is something that the group in Santa Ana is also very concerned with.
So there are organic links, as it were,
Yes, there are.
organic homologies. And what you're trying to do is enable people to come together who might otherwise remain separate,
Yes.
given that there are concerns that they may share.
Yes.
Wow, that is amazing. And how do you go about doing that?
Okay, well, I'm developing my own project in collaboration with my colleague, Mark Levine, who's the professor of history here at UCI, and Richard Matthew, who is the director of the Blum Center for the Alleviation of Poverty. And they have a broader project that deals with multiple sites in Africa, including Congo and Port Harcourt, to create development projects. So they're actual development and design projects that they're setting up. And then the filmmaking is something that sort of comes in tandem with that. So I'm interested in the media making component of this, and how we can make that media, get the media distributed not only to platforms that be accessible to universities in the United States, but basically get them to these community organizations in the United States so that community members can see what kind of media they're making and get inspired to share their own media.
So you've got partners who were there in situ and partners back in the US as well.
Yes.
So you've got both a grassroots connection and an outsider one. Wow, great. So I have to go turn to Orson, and it's all true now, Prof.
Yes. Okay.
Many listeners will not have heard of, if we can call it, the film. I think you refer to it in your book on the subject as a phantom film at one point.
Yes.
But everyone will have heard of Orson Welles and the idea of an enfant terrible whose career never really happened, whose career ended at 25, whose career was a series of disappointments and failures and all the rest of it, right? That sort of logic surrounds Wells. And it can be no more fully realized as a notion of disappointment and incompleteness than in the case of It's All True. But you have worked for a very long time to excavate it, to make sense of what it was and could be and might have been. So could you share with us the It's All True story?
Yes. Well, it's all true. And by the way, I'm happy to report that the footage for the film, which is totaling over 150,000 feet of nitrate footage, which we didn't completely use in 1993, is being scanned by Paramount in 4K.
Wow.
So that may not be the last that you see of It's All True or
Oh,
It's All True Coming. But in any case, this is after years of trying to fight for the preservation. But this film was a project that basically came about because of the good neighbor policy between the United States and Latin America. And Wells was one of those select few who could be a goodwill ambassador and basically helped to generate propaganda that would be pro-Allied during World War II by traveling to Latin America and becoming a media event. So the media event definitely happened with Wells. He was chased after by the Brazilian press on a daily basis. He also appeared in newsreels that the Department of Press and Propaganda in Brazil set up. But he decided to join this Brazilian project, where he went as goodwill ambassador to Mexico, and to make it a multi-part film that would focus on the diversity of Latin America and also what traits were actually shared maybe with people in the United States. So he did shoot a film about a young bull in Mexico who goes to the bull ring and is spared for his bravery. And that was My Friend Bonito. The footage was mostly shot. I think they had some dialogue scenes that were not shot yet. But that footage is at UCLA and is being preserved in 4K. And then there's footage shot in Brazil. The first footage was basically a documentary in Technicolor of Carnival. And Carnival and a reenactment of Carnival by some musicians who were very well known at the time, Heriberto Martins, Grande Otelo was one of the first Afro-Brazilian movie stars at the time. So that would be the story of samba and how music got from the favelas, from the shanty towns around Rio. How they got from there into the central square for performance during Carnival. And that would be joined to another episode, which was basically devoted to poor fishermen in the Northeast who decided to travel themselves on their raft, their sailing raft, about almost 2,000 miles from Ceará to Rio, to petition the Brazilian president for inclusion in his Social Security legislation. So they actually got the law changed so that fishermen were included in Social Security legislation. And so it's the story of these fishermen, one of whom was taught himself to read and write and kept a diary aboard the raft. And so part of that story is based on the diary, as well as footage of the community that sent them forth in Ceará. I have kept in touch with the Jangadeiros families, and they're doing okay, and they were happy to see the film, the documentary, when it was made in 1993. And I'm hoping they can see more of it as we continue with the preservation.
And it's important to say, not only did you write the book on this film, but You've also been involved, as you said, in this extraordinary documentary. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So one of Wells' associates in the original trip was Richard Wilson. And he had this dream of not finishing the film because at that point there was no way to really complete the film as Wells would have done it. There was some footage missing for the Jangaderos episode. A lot of the music for Carnival hadn't been found, the original music they recorded, which was just of incredible historical value. So there were these large portions of footage that could be used to tell a story about the film. So that was his approach. And he tried to find a producer for the film. And finally, Paramount got on board. They actually owned the footage that had been shot, because it showed up on the Desilu lot, and Desilu was acquired by Paramount. So I found a memo. Desjardins actually knew of the footage, and he actually tried to get the American Film Institute interested in it. So we have Paramount getting interested, and but in order to shoot the documentary in Brazil about the film, we had to get a French producer involved. So it was an international co-production with a French producer, Balenciaga.
And what was your place in all of this?
Oh, I was associate producer and I was the senior researcher for the
Yeah,
project.
no, quite. Thank you. And just for a bit of context for people, the good neighbor policy is partly to do with a legitimate anxiety of the United States about the role that Germany was playing in trying to infiltrate cultural life in South America in particular, yeah, in Argentina, in Brazil, and so on. And so FDR and his advisors decided that they'd better pay attention and provide some cultural ballast. Yeah, fair to say.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And to create actual exchanges of talent with Latin America so that Latin Americans can see themselves in what was going to be on the Hollywood screen. So that was one of the goals as well.
And so what went wrong with It's All True? There's Wells. He's fated in Brazil and probably in Mexico. He's there as a goodwill ambassador from the United States. He's just completed this masterpiece, Citizen Kane. Why doesn't it all bear fruit until you and others intervene half a century later?
Well, actually, what happened was that, he was very popular all over Latin America. He got these Best Actor awards from Argentina and Brazil for his role in Citizen Kane. And so they actually kept nicknaming him Citizen Kane. That's how you would see the headlines, the film, the project was supposed to take a couple of months. And actually, as he got into it, he realized that there was such a rich story to be told with the samba that it was going to take a few months just to reenact the samba part. And then it was going to take at least another month to film the Jangaderos part in the Northeast. And this was a time when there weren't labs in Brazil to develop the Technicolor. They had to send test strips to Argentina to be developed. So it was hard for people who were supporting the project to envision how it was basically going to, how, what shape it would take. And basically, he wanted to take a neorealist approach and not work with a finished screenplay, but rather to have a sort of rough outline, a sketch of what he was going to film. And he would improvise daily with his creative collaborators in Brazil, which was a perfect approach to good neighbor policy, right? Because basically, you're going to have the key creative talent be Brazilian and be Mexican instead of the other way around. So, what happened was that there were bad previews of Magnificent Ambersons in March of 1942. The studio was a little bit in turmoil because they weren't getting enough box office returns in general for their product. And so Wells was, the Wells project, the Wells Mercury unit was partly a casualty of this, period of time in RKO's history. And the pre they changed, they ousted the president of RKO during this time. And so they said that they could invoke wartime difficulties and get Wells out of the picture and not support the end of It's All True. So it was one thing to get Magnificent Ambersons released, and it was quite another thing to allow him to stay on the lot and complete this film that they couldn't quite envision very well because they didn't understand Brazilian society and culture. They didn't understand what these references were, which would have been explained in the film.
I
So
think.
they actually reacted in kind of a racist way, which was to say, this is something which couldn't be shown south of the Mason-Dixon line.
So there was
There's
an issue there about disclosing the blackness of Brazilian society, much of Brazilian society.
absolutely. Absolutely. And justifying why Grande Otelo should have such a prominent role in the film when we hadn't integrated the screen yet. I mean, in California, they hadn't integrated the screen with people acting alongside each other in a non-servile relationship.
So, what got you first interested in this? What impelled you forward?
Well, I lived in the northeast of Brazil when I was in college on an exchange. And I knew how different the northeast was from the south of Brazil, and the difficulties that people faced there. And it was actually Vidas Secas, the film by Nelson Pereira dos Santos, that got me interested in studying film in the first place. That's how I started, went to cinema studies at NYU. So I read in a book about Orson Welles, it was called Focus on Orson Welles by Ronald Gottesman, I think. And he mentioned that there was this film in which Orson Welles was going to was going to portray Grande Otelo in Carnival and also the Jangadeiros. And I thought, how does that combine? How could you possibly combine these regions in one film? And why would Orson Welles, of all people, do it? So I found out there was an archive that Richard Wilson set up with a lot of the script material and the correspondence. And that's how I went to visit the archive. And then the rest just started falling into
Go into
place.
place. Well, Prof, I have two more questions for you, if I may,
My goodness.
and then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you may wish to what we've said. Does that sound
Okay.
okay?
Yes.
So you've told us a fair bit about how you go about your research. There are interviews and so on, but could you just distill that for a moment? When you've
Yes.
got a project, how do you conceptualize it and how do you undertake its study?
Okay. For It's All True, it seemed very important to interview people who had actually participated in the project. And fortunately, my project was timed so that I could still interview them. They were still around. And so for that, I used oral history. And to create the oral histories, I took as many images as I could that I could find, photographs of the project to spark those memories of the actual scenes of the film. I did that in both Mexico and Brazil. In terms of the television project, I wanted to interview people who were watching this television and to engage them in conversation about their viewing. I also, because I wanted to get some quantitative data, I had to have a survey for that. And so what I used was a survey as a point of departure for kind of like an interview. And I went to places where people waited. I didn't want to invade their homes. I don't believe in that, necessarily as the kind of study of spectatorship. Instead, I wanted to sort of watch television with them in public spaces. So there are these, in immigrant neighborhoods, we have these sort of public-private spaces, right? Spaces that are locally owned businesses, but that become public places where people have conversations and engage in television viewing. So a lot of those were laundromats. I went to a lot of laundromats. And so that is how I went about the television book. I also went to community organizations and took advantage of those locations to conduct focus group discussions around media. In terms of my current project, I'm basically interviewing the directors or the public relations people connected to these community organizations, either in person or via Zoom. And I have some questions that I'm asking everyone, and then some, and then I tailor the interview to be to reflect the organization's activity.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful example of explaining mixed methods to people in ways that will make a lot of sense, I think. Thank you. So
Okay, hopefully.
my last question, Prof. C, before handing over to you to conclude, is to put this to you. I'm keen as a young rabbit, 22-year-old, knocking on your door, saying, Prof. C, I want to become you. I've just finished my undergrad. I want to be a media studies prof. What do I do?
Yes. Well, the first thing you need to do is to sort of decide what aspect of media you're interested in, what medium you're really interested in, because we do have these branches of our field. And I think that studying television is quite different from studying film. And you can look at maybe the interface of those two if you're if you would like. But it's important to sort of have a sense of what kind of what basis you want to start off from. Have a passion for media that where you can have where you have questions you want to answer about media, that there are questions you would like to ask the people who make those media, the people who distribute those media, the people who exhibit those media, and take those questions and develop them into a project where you're actually, I always advocate going into the field. That's just the way I approach things, and not just doing textual analysis, because I think we have a lot of scholarship that is basically textual analysis. And I think it's important to think about how you can deepen your study. Either by interacting with the people who create media, by creating maybe even videographic scholarship, which is now a new thing, or by talking to the people who actually consume these media and de developing a project where they can develop it.
Thank you. My keen inner rabbit is still keen.
Okay, thank you.
Catherine, could I invite you now to close by sharing with us any additional thoughts, perspective, points of inquiry you may wish to?
Well, it is my hope that this work will be relevant to the communities that have been engaged in it, and that somehow it can present it to them in terms of what we know as research justice, right? That you want to be able to return the product of your work in some way that makes sense to the community, communities that inspired it. And so that is something that I'm hoping to work on as I go forward, And I'll be interested in learning their reactions to it. So,
Thank you so much, Catherine. It was wonderful chatting to you.
thank you. And I hope you enjoy Madrid.